one of the partners was murdered about 3 weeks before we were supposed to close and sell it to him. He was killed by the same guy who killed Gianni Versace.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Stuart Jameson, a Scottish name there, if ever I heard one, from Unbridled Advisory. Now, I had a pre-interview with Stuart, and he's like the James Bond of CFOs. He's worked all over the year, and he has built up a reputation as a kind of special ops finance person who's been parachuted in to fix all sorts of situations around the world, everywhere from, if I'm not going too far outside here, everywhere from the Far East to dealing with the mob in Chicago. So let's dive into this episode today. Stuart, you can introduce yourself by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Well, not people don't know. I play a lot of golf, and sometimes I have to take my business calls on the golf course, and it's very difficult to conduct a good business call on the golf course without people hearing anything in the background. So I've gotten very good at hitting the mute button when I'm playing golf, and I could play a four-hour round of golf and have two or three meetings out there and get a lot done. And nobody knows what I'm doing out there. They certainly don't know I'm playing golf, but I mean, it's easy for me to focus and play golf at the same time.
Very good. I like it. Well, maybe some of your clients will know now if they listen to this. That's
I'm not sure I want my clients to know that, but yeah, I guess it's okay. As long as I get my work done and do it well, I don't think they have any complaints.
Okay. So a little bit of someone who's willing to play with the rules a little bit. I'm already picking up in your background here, but you have a very international career, but that started fairly early for you. Isn't that right? I mean, tell us a bit about where you grew up, and it's not your run-of-the-mill upbringing.
I grew up in Litchfield, Connecticut, went to a private high school, went to college in Bryant University in Rhode Island, and picked that school because I met the golf coach, and I played varsity golf for 4 years. Went to school and got my degree in finance and accounting. Got out of school, got a great job with Ernst & Young right out of the box. I think I was hired by the managing partner of Ernst & Young because I was a good golfer, and he wanted me to play golf with some of the clients, which I thought was pretty funny. But I only spent 2 years there and got my CPA and was a little bored doing the audit work that I was doing. So I ended up taking a job with a couple of Fortune 500 companies in a row as a special projects finance guy out of the audit group. And these companies were all Fortune 500, Fortune 100 companies that had operations all over the world. So
your international career here, in your upbringing, you have a special skill. You told me before we started, so you can speak patois. What's patois, and how the hell did you learn how to speak it?
Well, my dad grew up in Scotland, was born and raised there. Then he came to the U.S. and then he went to Jamaica in 1974. So when I was a young lad, I spent two or three months a year when I wasn't in school in Jamaica. So I was taught patois at a very young age, and I still go down to Jamaica. I was just down there last week. I love the Jamaican people, and I love speaking their language and understanding their language, which sometimes can be difficult.
Very good. So you had the EY audit background. I mean, that's a classic grounding, let's say, for someone with a finance ground, is to work in audit at a big four company. And then you got into
the big eight back then, just so you know.
Yeah. I actually, every time I say it out loud, I wonder what we're down to at this stage. It could be,
I think it's four now.
I was there when I worked for PwC when they merged with Coopers. Now, I was only a summer intern, but that was a big transition. I remember at the morning it happened, I was in London Bridge in the UK. Suddenly the partners came down to us and we were like the lowest of the low. And suddenly, but we were in the IT section. So they wanted to know what was breaking on the news. And they wouldn't tell us what was happening, but they were just waiting. Is there anything happening in the news, guys? And we never saw these guys. They were way too high up for us. And then a couple of hours later, we figured out what they were doing, you know? So,
yeah.
Okay,
no,
cool.
So good firms back in the day.
Yeah, they were. Well, it's all changing now. So you left EY and you've done 120 acquisitions. So a lot of work and this is for a PE firm. Is this right? Which was your first PE firm you worked for?
Yeah, well, I mean, so it went from Ernst & Young. I had to go there 2 years, get my CPA. Mm-hmm. I went on for the next 7 years and worked, you know, for the Fortune 500 companies, United Technologies, the Singer Company, Litton Industries. And I did acquisitions and special projects in 12 different countries and traveled 50 weeks a year. At that point, I met some private equity guys, and they liked the fact that I did acquisitions all over the world. I did due diligence. I did integration work. I did CFO work, operations, you know, turnaround restructuring. So a private equity group hired me in 1995, Stanford Capital Group. They were a specialty group in buying big holding companies and breaking them up, keeping pieces and selling pieces off.
Okay. So this is classic, what the press likes to call big, bad private equity, breaking up companies and selling off the asset stripping and, you know, the big, bad boogeyman, especially in the 1990s.
We did keep a lot of companies out of them, and they were more distressed companies and that needed turning around before we could sell them.
So there's a broad swage of experience there. So that sounds like everything from playing on a spreadsheet down to on the factory floor, figuring out problems, and you seem to have spanned it all. You were sent out to the Far East as one of your early assignments, and you had the job of, what were you doing in the Far East? You were outsourcing U.S.
Well, I was there multiple times. I was there in Thailand for the Singer Company that had about a $500 million operation over there that they sent me over there to try to figure out what was going on and why they weren't making enough money. But I spent more time in the Far East and in China specifically for the private equity groups when we bought a big manufacturing company that had three operations, three factories in the U.S., one in California, one in Texas, and one in Ohio. And we owned the company, and it was not very profitable any longer. It was distressed. And what we decided we had to do is we had to shut down two of the three factories in the United States, which were unionized, which wasn't fun. But we had to shut them down. It took us about a year to shut them down. And at the same time, we had to start finding a partner in the Far East that could make our product, send our molds over there and copy and make our products for a price that could be competitive in the United States. We were the third largest vitreous China company in the U.S. behind the two big names, Kohler and American Standard. So that was a long ordeal. We also found significant fraud at the corporate headquarters back in the day, because it was part of a big conglomerate we bought. So we bought a big company, we sold off a bunch of the companies, and this one was kept on their books. They must have had a lot of accruals left from the old parent company. And they kind of started cooking the books by reversing accruals every month. So they still showed EBITDA, which was, you know, it looked like the company was doing well. There was EBITDA every month. But the CFO kept calling us and saying, I need more cash, I need more cash. And that didn't make a lot of sense to me, because I'm, you know, a financial guy. I looked at the financials and go, why do you need cash? You got plenty of EBITDA each month. But it kind of started to smell a little bit. And then I figured out that they were just reversing accruals every month and not letting us know, not letting the parent company, the private equity group, know what was going on. So I ended up having to go out there and terminate the entire corporate staff.
Well, Charlie Munger, God bless his soul, famous for saying BS earnings. That's what he called EBITDA, right? And private equity firms love them, right? They love
them. We live by EBITDA because everything's a multiple of EBITDA, you know, at the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah. So you got the statements and everything looked fine. How far in did you have to go? Like, were these journal entries or what was the moment that you figured out, hold on, now I get what's going on here? How did you figure it out?
Well, I mean, I should have been probably looking a little closer, but we were in the middle of 10 transactions at every moment of every day during every year. So, and I'd get the financials. It was my responsibility to look at them. And then when he kept asking for cash, that's when I started going, why do you need cash? And then I started just going through, send me your trial balances. So I had him send me the trial balances, and then I could start seeing what was going on. Then I'm like, oh God, this is not good. There is no cash flow. There's just, he's reversing things at the end of the month. It's a big accrual from the old parent company, and he was creating false EBITDA.
So the accrual was an expense which was being taken back off. Is that right? So they had spent, they had made a big capital expense or whatever in the parent company, and they were able to just strip that out to create the illusion of having some.
It was just a lot of old deferred expenses that were on the books from the old parent company, from intercompany transactions and whatever. You know, we didn't worry about it in the beginning because, you know, we now hired the team that was in charge of the company for years. Mm-hmm. So it took us about 3 or 4 months when they've asked for cash for me to figure it out. And then my boss has said, you need to go out there and figure out what's really going on. I got the CFO in a room and I said, okay, why do you need cash? Your EBITDA's here. And he kind of blew the whistle on himself.
So tell me about that conversation, because I love the human drama and all this. And I'm going to ask you about the unions in a second, because I have my own story with unions.
Well, it's not a fun one, because I hope he's not watching this podcast. So, you know, it was a number of years ago. So, but, you know, I just called him out. I said, there's no way you can need cash. You need to tell me why. And I can see your trial balance and you're playing games here. And does everybody know? And he basically said, you know, I was forced to do it by the CEO and the COO, and we needed cash to keep the factories alive, which were, you know, Texas, California, and Ohio. Mm-hmm. And I have a way of making people tell me the truth when I get them cornered. And it wasn't physical or anything. It was just, you know, I got you. What's the story? And he had to come clean. And I had to call our corporate office, and I go, you know, I won't use the guy's name, but it's our CEO of the private equity group. And I said, what do you want me to do? He goes, I need you to call security company. I need you to get the security company in the office as soon as you can. And I need you to confiscate all their computers and have them walked out the door.
Wow.
So, I've had to do that a couple of times in my life, believe it or not. Once was with another CEO in another fraudulent situation.
So what was the impact then? Does that mean the PE firm was sold a bill of goods and you were going to try and do a clawback, or things brushed under the carpet like a lot of these things are?
Not really. We bought a $450 million company that had three good divisions. And what we had planned to do was sell off, you know, three good divisions. And we knew this one was a little underwater. It wasn't doing that well. So we decided we were going to keep it, fix it, turn it around and sell it. So,
got it.
You know, that's just what we specialize in doing.
Okay, so that's part of the game. It's like buying a returns pallet from Amazon. You know there's going to be some stuff in there. That's the risk you're taking. There's going to be able to eke out enough good stuff by the end of it.
If you ever watched the movie Pretty Woman, it's sort of what we specialize in doing, buying big holding companies and breaking them up, selling them off for more money, mm-hmm. and keeping certain pieces. And I don't think Pretty Woman, that they did that, but we had to keep certain parts of companies.
So were there, it sounds like there was no impact here. It sounds like you just, whatever, got all the evidence. Did you shut it down? Was there any repercussion for anyone?
We did not pursue legal action against the CEO, the COO, and the CFO, and the operations people there. Walked them out the door. My boss said, well, you're running the company now. And I'm like going, okay, here we go. I moved to Ohio, and I had a great guy in the factory in Ohio that was a special forces guy, big guy, big tall guy. And I brought him in under the wing and I said, this is what was going on. And he goes, I never liked those guys at corporate anyway. They never showed up here anyway. So him and I worked together for the next 2 years to fix the company, shut down factories and outsource to the Far East to keep the company alive. We did that for the next 2 or 3 years. Rebuilt the company to a very profitable company and then sold it.
So let me ask about this union piece, because my family history, my great-great-grandfather, actually, who was Scottish, funnily enough, built a bakery that lasted 120 years in Dublin. And the family lore is that in 1970s, the unions shut it down. The other guys started baking on a Sunday, and the unions were like, we don't bake on a Sunday. And then everyone bought the bread somewhere else, and the whole thing fell apart. So I'm always a little bit tilted when it comes to the unions. You have your special forces guy under your wing. Did that become necessary? when you were dealing with the unions and you were shutting down these, like, how rough does it get? Well, I feel like I have this Tony Soprano view of unions.
No. Yeah. No, it was, he had the respect of all the employees in the factories because he worked the factories. He controlled the factories.
Right.
And basically, there was no option. We would have had to bankrupt the company and shut down everything, and everybody would have lost their jobs. So there was no way out. So, you know, unfortunately, mm-hmm. the one in California was the highest, you know, cost per unit producer of our products. The one in Texas was second. The only one that we could save was the one in Ohio. It barely made profit, but it was 20%, you know, better pricing, better cost structure than the other ones. And it wasn't fun, but, you know, he did most of the hard work dealing with the unions, but it was like, what are you going to do? Everybody's going to lose their job anyway. So we made contractual arrangements to settle with the employees and pay them out some severance and keep certain people for 6 months while we're liquidating the assets and things like that. We did it in the nicest way possible, which may sound not possible, but we spent a lot of money trying to make people happy to help us liquidate the assets. It took us a year to you know, exit both factories, which wasn't fun. It was a very depressing time because you're watching everybody losing their jobs and their families. And I mean, the one in California was in a very prime area, so there wasn't a distressed area. The one in Texas wasn't a distressed area. The one in Ohio, if we had to shut down that would have been a nightmare because that one was in a very unique area that didn't have a lot of employment besides our factory.
So. Right. Well, the story that I hear entrepreneurs tell themselves when they have to let people go is that everyone else goes on to something better. You know, they always say, no, listen, everyone always has a better situation. I don't know how true that is. It can't be true all the time, but it's normally true, I think. I think it's just that they just work somewhere else. When you think, well, you have to let someone go, well, really all it means is they work somewhere else. It's unlikely that they work nowhere. Right?
You can only hope. You can only hope that they bounce back and they got enough severance to find another job somewhere while they still had their severance.
You mentioned that you spent money to help ease the transition. Was there money that you was well spent and money you wouldn't spend again, or you learned from it? Actually, you know what, didn't help. Sometimes you feel like you do these things to be a nice guy and you wonder afterwards, does it matter? People still are going to feel the way they're going to feel.
I'm sure, you know, there was a lot of anger, but I mean, we did the best we could and we had no violence. And they were big unions and they were over 1,000 employees in each factory. So there was no mm-hmm. violence. Thank God for the Special Forces Green Beret guy who was the president of the operating company. So
got it. Okay, so let's move on to Spain. You were parachuted in, let's continue the theme here of special operations. You're parachuted in to very nice. Sounds like a much easier job. Working in Spain doesn't sound too stressful to me. What were you doing there? And what was the contrast in work environment from the US?
That's a little funnier because I was sent over from our US parent company to go find out why they weren't making any money over there. The productivity was poor and all that. And that one was a little bizarre. I went over there. I was 27 years old when I was parachuted in. That one was basically, I went to work there every day to try to figure out why we weren't making any money. I'm looking through all the financials. I'm looking through talking to all the operations people. But it came to me after being there for the first month or the first couple of weeks is, you know, they get to work at 8 o'clock. Everybody didn't look very good at 8 o'clock. And at 12 o'clock, we'd go to lunch and they'd go to lunch for like hour to 2 hours. They drank at lunch. And I guess that was the norm. So the employees would get there, they go out to lunch, they drink at lunch, you know, one or two, or some of them had three drinks. I'm sitting there watching this going, wow, that's crazy. They drink for lunch, they get back from lunch, they're now tired and needing a nap. And I mean, they functioned, but I mean, they functioned at 50%. And then they would be done at 5:30 at night. And I hung around with a lot of the employees to try to, you know, figure out what was going on over there. And at 5:30 at night, they'd all go home. They all go for siesta. And they'd wake up at 9 o'clock And then they'd go out for a late night dinner and drink some more. And I did this for 3 months. And I'm like, oh my God, it's easy to see why this company doesn't function properly. And it's got, you know, poor financials and the productivity is poor. And But unfortunately, that was how the companies worked in Spain. And, you know, I found that most of them worked the same way. And came back to corporate and reported that. And, you know, it wasn't really easy to make adjustments. We basically put in the rules that there was no alcohol consumption at lunchtime allowed anymore. And other reasons we would, if we found out people were drinking at lunch and not being productive in the afternoon, that would be, they would have rights to, for termination. We would have rights to terminate, which we had to hire lawyers in Spain and everything else and get involved in all what can happen in the employees, you know, what employee laws were over there. So it was a long time ago. It was a fun project, but, you know, nothing exciting from a financial standpoint.
Very good. Okay, well, it's not so easy to get rid of people in Europe, right? So it's not, you have to get your ducks in a row. In the US, it's a lot easier as I understand it, but you have to, it takes months basically, even if they are drinking at lunchtime. Okay, so let's wrap it up then with your experience, which I have to ask about, your yellow cab business. You had an interesting brush with the person, maybe you can tell the story about who owned this yellow cab business and what happened to him.
Well, yellow cab, that was a big, we didn't purchase it directly. We purchased a large holding company as we normally did. We purchased a large holding company that owned three different operations. We broke them up. We sold off the big transportation company to a large high net worth family in Chicago. We sold off an automotive stamping company to a public company in the UK. The other companies were, it was a taxi company out of the Midwest and an insurance company out of the Midwest that specifically did transportation insurance. Let's just say we were going to sell the taxi company right away. That was the plan because none of us in the private equity group had any experience. This one was a pure breakup and selling off the pieces. But the buyer for the cab company, there was two partners, and one of the partners was murdered about 3 weeks before we were supposed to close and sell it to him. Fortunately, the partner was a very wealthy billionaire, and he was killed by the same guy who killed Gianni Versace months later. He was finally caught when he killed Gianni Versace, but he wasn't caught when he killed the gentleman in the Midwest. Unfortunately, in that situation, we ended up having to keep the company. When I went out there to go take over the company with the current president, it came to our attention that the medallions were worth a lot of money, much more money than what we were selling the company for. So we went into a 4 or 5 year liquidation of those assets after changing half of the taxis to a different color and changing their name, which was because the city thought we had a monopoly on the cab business because we had over 2,000 medallions.
So the name change was interesting. Tell us the story about how. So just to step back. So the city was getting antsy because you had too many medallions, felt like it was a monopoly. That was part of the pressure they were putting on you. What could they do? I mean, try to break you up? Was it possible?
They were trying to break us up. And actually one night when we were out having dinner and drinks, my partner came up with a really good thought. And we spelled the company backwards and changed the color of the company. And the city really didn't bother us for another couple of years. And we started liquidating medallions. We started financing the medallion liquidation, selling off them to people that could buy them and financing it as well. Turned out that the medallions were worth almost double what we were going to sell the company for.
So the city got what they wanted. They got rid of their monopoly. And actually it worked out better for you because it was worth more like that anyway. Very cool. All right. So maybe you can just tell us a bit about now what you're doing at Unbridled Advisory. Maybe I'll ask you about the name. Why Unbridled? And who do you do it for?
Well, I didn't come up with a name. I was approached by the guy who founded the company, and he asked me if I would join them and help him lead the M&A and CFO services group. So agreed to it. Sounded like an interesting play. I like, you know, as a private equity guy for 25 plus years, and an operations partner for three private equity groups. It's exactly what I do. I go in and I help companies from small companies. We actually even do some startup companies. I wouldn't say complete startups. I would say companies in their first 2 or 3 years that have special technology and are run by scientists, things like that. We do design companies. We do manufacturing companies. We do medical companies, high-tech companies that are involved in semiconductors. We help them from their initial bookkeeping to their accounting, to their journal entries, to their QuickBooks, to NetSuites, to Xero. We do everything from the, let's put it this way, from the bookkeeping up to their CFO services. And we help them raise capital. We put together business plans, you know, confidential information memorandums. We reach out to investor people that we know. We're not broker dealers, so we don't do the broker dealer piece, but we will find people that are interested in funding these companies, connect the companies, and help them get transactions done with lawyers and making sure they do the proper documentation, schedule the Form Ds and things like that. You know, we have good attorneys that know what they're doing. So, but we try to stay away from the broker dealer part of the business.
So it must be tempting. I mean, the value is captured, is that the right way to explain it, when a transaction happens? So you're not a broker, but do you look for fees on a transaction basis, or?
We get paid as consultants, advisors, financial advisors, putting together all their financial information, their historical information, putting together, you know, 30, 40, 50 page confidential information memorandums. So we get paid as consultants. We sometimes get finder fees. You need to be very careful to avoid the broker dealer conflicts, but we don't negotiate the terms and things like that. We get lawyers involved to do that work. So we're very careful about, you know, stepping over that line. But we do a lot of sell side and buy side transactions, but it's always as a consultant, advisor, putting together the decks in all of that work. We actually save companies from broker dealer fees. You know, broker dealer fee, if you're raising $20 million, we'll charge a 5-6% fee, maybe take some equity. You know, that could be substantial amounts of money. We do a lot of the services, but are not a broker dealer. And we probably cost the client, you know, anywhere between 20 and 40% of what a broker dealer would cost them. So we save them a lot of money. And in selling companies the same way and buying companies the same way.
So what I'm hearing there is you're straight up, you know, a consultancy fee, an hourly rate or a fixed fee, you know exactly what you're getting. And then you know how to negotiate with the broker to get that money back and more. So you're working with a broker. Because that's,
well, no, we're not.
Oftentimes brokers merge all this together.
We're working with principals. So what we'll do is we'll do a buy side, sell side transaction and charge $10,000 or $15,000 a month. And any overages that we accrue, we'll get them, we get the, our overages, our consulting fee or overages paid once there's a, once they finalize the transaction and they've gotten funding and all that stuff, they'll pay us back our consulting fees that were hourly fees. We, you know, we do this, maybe we'll do a $10,000 upfront fee a month and we're billing, our billables are $20,000, $30,000 a month. So we'll defer our fees, our hourly fees until they have a transaction that's completed, with the help of us and attorneys and them putting together their own subscription agreements with lawyers and everything else. So we'll get paid our deferred comp later on once there's a closing. So that's how we avoid the broker dealer piece. It's just basically hourly work that we do.
I like it. Nice and clear. So my last question here is, who is your business hero and why?
Who's the business hero? I mean, I've worked with a lot of great people over the years. One guy, one successful guy that comes to mind is a guy named Jamie Salter, who worked with us back in the, let's say, 2007, 8, 9, 10 area, when the markets, you know, when everything fell apart. You know, there was a major crash and all that stuff, but there was a interesting character on our board who did the transactions with us, Jamie Salter. And great guy, very aggressive guy, out of Canada, lived in New York, a lot of fun, worked hard worker. He'd work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But when we finally closed a bunch of companies, when we sold some of our companies off, he went on to start another company called Authentic Brands Group. And he got some initial funding from a private equity group, high net worth family. I think he only started off with maybe $100 million. But he went on to turn that $100 million into, I believe, his Authentic Brands Group is probably a $20, $30 billion company, has massive value. He's created a huge net worth for himself, built a great team, still probably works 24 hours, 24/7. But he was a really interesting character. So I kind of always think of him as like, I went another direction, and I probably in hindsight should have followed and worked with him.
Well, you might not have been playing golf and dealing with your clients.
No, I'm sure he wouldn't allow that.
That would have gone by the wayside.
But I did a lot in with that group and onwards, and with my other partners, we did a lot of transactions in New York, bought a lot of, you know, retail companies, consumer brand companies. I ran Pussers, British West Indies for years in the BVI. Unfortunately, we got destroyed by Hurricane Irma and Maria. And it was a $30 million company that I spent a lot of years with. It's a famous rum company, Pussers Rum too, but we ran the restaurants and the apparel part side of the company because of Tidehouse rules. You couldn't do the liquor and the restaurant side. Unfortunately, in 2017, we got destroyed by hurricanes, completely shredded. And then we rebuilt the company up until 2020, started opening the company again, and then COVID shut us down, and the British Virgin Islands really shut us down. And me as the president wasn't even allowed to go down there for the next 2 years. And unfortunately, after rebuilding the company, after being destroyed by hurricanes, we had to liquidate the assets of the company, which is probably my biggest failure in my life. And I can't say it was because of me or any of the people involved. You know, hurricane category fives are, you know, something that you can't foresee down there. And we really lost every building, every office, all our inventory, all our restaurants, just shredded. So I had 5 years of my life in it and a lot of my capital in it. And we lost a lot of money. All of our investors lost a lot of money in that project. And it was nothing on earth we could do between Category 5 and COVID. So that's my biggest miss in my life. And I don't know if you were going to ask me that, but it came to mind when we're finishing up our call. So
Thanks for sharing that. I mean, it sounds a bit glib when I say it now, but you're either learning or earning. But in an act of God like that, what do you learn out of that? I don't know. Like,
that was my job. I was going to be the president and expand the company around the world and work that one until I retired. And unfortunately, it didn't work out.
All right. Well, a little bit of a down note on the end, but I guess we can seem to be smiling now. So I'll think of you on the golf course instead of in hurricane torn BVI.
It's not all. I mean, I am gonna try to buy the rum company, so maybe I can make this all turn around in another way and buy the rum company and make it all back for everybody. So yeah, Everything's not down and out.
Very good. Well, Stuart, thank you very much for being on the show. I really enjoyed it. I know we had a whole page of other stuff we could have talked about here, but maybe part two someday. And thank you very much for listening. If you're still here, congratulations. Your special reward is to be able to go to pyramidexpress.com/CFO Mastermind. We're running monthly fractional CFO masterminds. They've been a big hit. If you want to come, if you're a fractional CFO, you want to come along, we put you in a breakout room with 3 or 4 other fractional CFOs in a similar revenue strata. And you can bring a business problem you're working on or practice problem, whatever, and you get feedback from your peers. So go to procurementexpress.com/CFO mastermind and we'll see you there. And thanks for that. Thanks, Stuart.
It's been fun. I wish we did have more time, as I really didn't get to talk much about our unbridled advisory clients, but you know, maybe next time.
Maybe we'll do it in the next one. All right. You're welcome back anytime.
All right. Bye-bye. Take care.